All right, the thing about music instruments in general is that this whole enchilada is built on copying, cloning, and stealing. That's also the case for music itself. The whole thing is built on a mountaintop of stealing other stuff from other people.
Hello, and welcome to the Open Hardware Manufacturing Podcast, the podcast about making open source hardware. My name is Stephen Haas.
And I'm Lucian Chapar.
And today we have a very, very awesome guest. Thea Flowers has come onto the podcast. Thea, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here.
This is an awesome talk. It went very, very long, and I'm sure we're going to have you on for a million other individual topics that we talk about this whole time. But we get into how you got into doing software and hardware and kind of how you transitioned into doing open stuff, all of the open source projects that you maintain and have started, and your relationship with Obligation, and what amount of contribution do you give back to them. What is it like to run an open hardware company and a lot of your ethos around open source?
A lot of stuff about me, which is...
is the point.
is deeply unsettling, but...
that's the whole reason.
Hopefully entertaining to people,
yeah,
right?
I have no doubt that it will be. Like, yeah, this is a great talk. I'm so glad that we had you on. I have like four or five things in our episode list that are tagged like have Thea on for them.
Oh yeah.
I think it's just going to be super good.
How to tank your podcast ratings in five episodes.
No, you're so much more accomplished and talented than you give yourself any credit for.
Yeah, you really are.
oh my God. Leave me alone. But no, this was great. It was so fun talking to you guys. Yeah, I had a good time.
It was good. All right, shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So, Thea, to start out, would you tell us just a little bit about who you are and your general jam? Just the thesis, Thea.
My general jam. So general jam is a pretty, you know, untalked about military leader over the last 50 years. I'm kidding. Scratch that. Let's start over.
Okay.
So general jam is my new project where I'm selling a bunch of different preserves.
Thea, this reminds, have you seen the clip of Robin Williams where they ask him to say that like one sentence for an ad and he just refuses to say the line for 20 minutes and gives them gold the whole time? Do you know this clip I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's so, I love it. I love that clip.
Oh man. So let's start from the top on that one.
Okay.
I'm Thea. I am a creative technologist and open source advocate. That's my general jam. I have done everything from programming to hardware design to being a semi-paid musician.
How can you be semi-paid?
Well, you know, sometimes we made money and sometimes we did.
Oh, okay.
One time I played a show and we made $7. Not like $7 each, but like $7
total
all together. And
buys you a drink at some venues.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Didn't even pay for gas, but sure.
Right.
Yeah. So I've done a lot of stuff. I do a lot of things, probably more than I should. but that's my nature. I consider myself chaotic good most of the time.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I like that allocation. So before we get into like all the stuff you do, and there is a lot, and that is going to be the meat of this thing. There's always the, how did you get to the chaotic good nature that you have on the day-to-day basis? Like, what was the process of getting there? So that's like school, early jobs and stuff before you kind of are out doing your own thing, doing all the open stuff that you do. So what was that like?
Yeah, you know, I feel like for the most part, my career trajectory has been me kind of stumbling into whatever. Like, when I was a teenager, I was convinced that I was going to be a musician, a touring musician, a working musician. That was what I was going to do. That did not happen. I thankfully had a really nerdy hobby, which was I got into programming because I wanted to make video games.
Yeah.
I never made video games, just like I never became a touring musician that got paid a decent amount of money to eat. So when I was trying to do this in my early 20s, I was also like doing a side gig at a computer place and also doing some open source thing as a matter of just a hobby.
Like in high school you were?
Yeah. I learned how to program in high school. So.
But what open source, you were working already on open source in high school?
Yeah, I actually have some contributions to KDE that are no longer there because they've redone everything. So.
KDE? Are you kidding me, Thea? Okay, for people who don't know what that is, quick context, what is that?
KDE is the K desktop environment. So it's one of the two big ones in Linux, the other one being GNOME. But
that's insane. I did not know that. That is so cool.
I mean, it's not a big of a deal. Like when I was a teenager, like I got really into Linux and like programming and stuff.
Yeah.
And I loved KDE, and I used the music player that was in KDE at the time called Amarok constantly.
Yeah.
And so I would always run into bugs, and I was learning C and C++ at the time. So like I would just fix some bugs here and there. So there's nothing major. There's nothing like super cool that I did. It's just like I fixed some crashes here or there, right? Like,
no, I'm going to fight you on that. That's cool as hell. In high school, you were fixing a desktop environment for Linux. I was picking my nose in high school. Like, that's cool.
I was bashing rocks together.
I mean, I was doing those things too, but also like, yeah. But anyways, like programming was always this nerdy hobby that I didn't really tell anybody about because I wanted to be this cool, like, you know, I'm a guitar player. So, you know, I tried doing that for a while. And, you know, I was in a band. We toured around the Southeast a little bit, but never really broke out. And eventually I was like, I need to get a real job and like pay rent. So I started moonlighting for a web design firm while still working at the computer place because it was a steady paycheck. And eventually the guy that ran that was like, so how much are they paying you over there? Because I'll pay you that plus like 10% if you just come work for me. And I'm like,
wow, cool,
done. So I started programming in PHP for like 2 years.
Let's go.
Yeah. From there, it was switching things up, working for consulting firms for a while. I worked at a company that got acquired by Accenture like 2 months after I left and forfeited my options. So
no,
I'm really good at timing things.
Wow. That sucks.
Damn.
I'm not too mad about it. It was sucking the life out of me. So,
yeah,
you know,
yep,
that's fine. And then I worked for Google for 6 years.
For 6 years?
Yep. And then I left Google and then started doing my own thing.
Right.
So like that's kind of been my trajectory. I didn't go to college. I couldn't afford it. I also had really bad grades in high school because I had undiagnosed ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
I was the kind of kid that would like ace every test, but never do any homework.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's not something you can get away with forever. They eventually catch up to you and they're like, oh, you can't do that. Yeah. So that led to the fun like thing of like absolutely acing the AP US history exam and almost failing the class.
Right. That weird dichotomy of like, yeah, I know this stuff well, but the structure of how people will grade you just does not jive with how I operate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I didn't go to college. So, you know, that's a double-edged sword. On one hand, I don't have a bunch of crippling student loan debt. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I did miss a bit of an experience, right? So I've had to pick up a lot of things as I go, and I've had to learn things from a more hands-on, practical perspective.
Right.
And then fill in the gaps with self-learning on concepts and higher levels.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that's something that lasts for your whole life and not just the 4 years of college. Like if you rely on learning from a professor, you're done after 4 years or you have to pay for another thing. And I've watched you do this of like dive into a thing and like 3 days later, you're like, so I'm an expert on XYZ now. I hate to make a Marvel reference, but that's a, you know, the Tony Stark thing where he's like, so last night I stayed up all night and became a nuclear physicist expert or whatever. And like, if you learn to learn, then everything is accessible. You just have to decide to put the time aside.
I try not to be Tony Stark on a regular basis.
Yeah, I hear that.
But yeah, like being able to learn things and just try things out is probably like the only thing that's really been like a constant in my life and career is like, I don't let the fact that I don't know something stop me from trying.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like the difference between someone who looks at a new like musical instrument is like, I don't know how to play that, so I'm not going to try to play that.
Right.
And someone who looks at a new musical instrument is like, I've never seen this before. I'm going to go mess with it. I'm that person.
Yeah. So that whole time you're doing consulting and like programming was a hobby and then it became a job.
Yep.
Almost by accident. Like you did it for on the side for extra money and then it kind of became your full time thing. And where did the music stuff go with that? Because like Winter Bloom's a thing now, which we'll get to in a second. But like, did you at some point go, you know what? Programming's really my jam. Like software development's the thing I'm more interested in or like would prefer to pursue because you're still a musician.
Right.
You know, that hasn't left your life.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it got to the point where it was just, I was putting so much into trying to be a musician and the band and the, you know, the crew that I was involved with just wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like we made $7 on a show, you know, sure. And like there's good stories that came out of that too, right? There's definitely like you know, situations where we did a show and we got paid way more than we expected.
Right.
And it just wasn't consistent enough. And then the people that I was playing with were kind of starting to burn out a bit. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where like rehearsal sessions would just not be very good. No one was focused on it. And I was like, this isn't going anywhere. I need to do something else.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't really feel like pivoting or like moving to a different band. And I didn't really have anyone in mind that I'd wanted to perform with. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, maybe I'll just go do some programming stuff for a minute.
Yeah.
So that was there, right?
Yeah.
So like what happened with music was like for years, I kind of just didn't really pursue it much, which mm-hmm. kind of sucked. Like probably not too long after I switched to, you know, not really performing with other people and doing programming, like a lot of my equipment got stolen and I didn't replace it.
Oh,
and
wow. Yeah.
There was like a couple of years of my life where I just really didn't play any music. Like that sucked.
Yeah.
So like rediscovering music and, you know, I originally was a guitar player, but like rediscovering music and discovering synthesizers and that leading into like or joining up with my interest in electronics to lead me to making a music technology company was a really fulfilling thing. It was like this marriage of two parts of my brain that had been separated for a while.
Right. And also literally in terms of how your jobs and career kind of went, like you're doing contracting. And then you did music and then you made it so that you can do like the engineering work and the music all in one thing. That's so freaking sick.
Were you playing with electronics in high school? Like where'd that angle come from?
Yeah. So kind of and kind of not. Like I didn't have a lot of money in high school. So I didn't have access to a lot of the things that would let me goof around with electronics.
Yeah.
But I loved messing with computers. I had a bunch of gel computers that I spliced together,
yeah.
Which is one of the reasons I loved Linux, is because Linux would run on basically anything that I could throw together.
Yeah.
And I did get a chance to do robotics in high school, which helped a lot with me sort of getting some exposure to electronics and things like that. But really, it wasn't until later in life that I really got into electronics and had access to stuff so that I could experiment with it.
Sick. So I want to start getting into, I mean, you have done so many things and are involved in so many different projects. And like, this is the OHM podcast, open hardware, but there's also a lot of open software stuff that you've done. So I want to start with that. And then we go into hardware in Winterbloom.
Yeah, that's sort of the curse of being ADHD is that I don't, like, my career is spread over a bunch of different things.
I don't think it's a curse. I mean, you just have this cool, like, array of things that you've been involved in, you know, like, it I don't know. I think it's cool. But so software-wise, you've started open source projects, you've kicked off open source project, you're in the middle of working on an open source project, joined a very, very big open source project of a programming language, so maybe we start with Python. What was the first like dip into open source software contribution that you had? Like, you know, obviously KDE you already talked about, but like, what was that path of like starting to go through and contribute and start creating your own open source projects, open source software?
Yeah, like there's so much. Like it's hard to even enumerate that journey because it's just, I learned how to program because of open source.
Right.
So like contributing back just felt natural.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a point where I'm like, oh, I've learned how to program now. I've been programming for 6 years. Now I'm going to contribute to open source.
Sure.
It was, as I'm learning, I'm going to contribute back. So like, you know, going back to KDE, at the time I was learning C and C++. So it's like, okay, cool. I'm going to contribute to something and something that I use. And that was that. And then, you know, when I was programming PHP, I contributed to KPHP, to their documentation, some bug fixes and stuff. And it was just like a matter of procedure. Like it was just what you do, yeah. Right? Like that was my idea of it, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
And the same thing when I started programming more Python, it just made sense to start contributing and to contribute to the things that I thought were interesting and things that I thought would be useful to other people. And, you know, it was also through this journey that I discovered my love of technical writing and how that as a contribution is a great way to get familiar with a new project, but also to really amplify the efforts of yourself and others is through technical writing.
Making it more accessible because you can write a great thing, but if no one knows how to use it, it kind of doesn't matter. Like,
exactly.
You know, people have to be able to use it to get the benefit of it. Did your love for technical writing come from your contracting work? Is that kind of where it started, or was it Google, or, you know, where did you kind of start to see or open source contributions? Like, where did you start to fall in love with that? Because you're, especially with Key Canvas, which we'll get into in a sec, like your docs are really nice. Like your write-ups for your products are like incredibly intuitive and easy to read. And like, you know, they're great. They're absolutely excellent. So did that come, where did you start liking to do that? And like, you know, where'd you hone that process?
I don't know if I could like trace it to a single moment or a single thing. Mm-hmm. Like it started when I started doing PHP stuff, because PHP is such an interesting thing. Like everybody loves to hate on it, and there's good reasons for that. But like one of the interesting things about the PHP documentation, I don't know if this is still true, but on every docs page, there used to be comments, and a lot of comments would be so incredibly helpful, right? And like, I mean, this was before like Stack Overflow really took over, and it's like, That's amazing. Like there's so much knowledge tied up in that. And it's like, update the docs then, you know? And, you know, early on messing with Cake PHP, like contributing to that documentation was such a positive experience that like it made me want to continue to do that for other projects. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, and doing consulting, you do a lot of writing that isn't code. You know, especially like working at like a consulting firm where you have to write up requirements and estimates and, you know, statements of work and all of this jazz. And it's like, you have to do so much writing. And so like, that didn't give me any passion for it, but it gave me practice, right? Sure. And then like going to Google and working in developer relations there, I had the opportunity to work with some really, really amazing technical writers. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I did was like literally just sit next to one of the technical writers that didn't find me obnoxious and just like absorbed everything I possibly could from them.
Yep, yep.
And then kept working with them.
Like, right.
And that gave me a huge passion for technical writing.
Yeah.
And also just interactivity. That's one of the things I really love to do with my technical writing is add interactivity and illustrations and things like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that came from my desire to make video games and my, you know, experience early on in programming with making graphic stuff. It's like, yeah, it's if there's a chance that I can make something interactive that's going to help illustrate my point, I'm going to do that. Right.
And like some of the pages that you have for your synths, like you have these like wave generator tools where you can like watch how the wave is made. It's almost like a tutorial of like wave synthesis and stuff. And like you've built out this whole tool just for the sake of explaining to people how it operates better. Like it's rad. It's super. It really is really cool. Like it feels like a little video game or like a little story that you're being walked through.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I really love about technical writing and kind of weaseling it in with the more narrative writing, right? Because I do like narrative writing. When I was in developer relations, some of the people that I worked with were like, you know, developer relations is about telling a story. We craft stories.
Yep.
The stories we craft are around engineering and development, but we're still crafting stories. And that's like, no one's going to find a doc string narratively compelling, right? But as developer relations, our job is to bring together these smaller pieces and make something that is narratively compelling.
Yeah.
Right. And when I write product manuals, there's not a whole lot of narrative that I can spin.
Yeah.
But like when I write things like my article on the design of the Roland Juno oscillator, there was a narrative that I was able to make throughout that entire article, which is sort of this building on top of each other. Like you, like I'm taking you through as an engineer, how you would create this from basic building blocks. Right. And having just that little thread of narrative going through it helps people follow it and understand what's going on.
Yeah. It's great. And that leads kind of into why Key Canvas exists, right? Is that the thesis of why you started that?
Yeah. I mean, the thesis of why I started Key Canvas was because I can't leave well enough alone. As I started getting into hardware, I've started writing more about hardware. And, you know, that involves showing to some extent schematics and layouts inside of articles.
Yeah.
And the typical way of doing that is just take a screenshot and put it in there, right? Yeah. Like everybody does. It's fine. The problem is that, like, there's a lot of stuff that isn't usually shown in a screenshot that is hiding behind that, right? And for me, I hated that, like, I was losing that context. And can I just like make these maybe an SVG and then I can annotate them? So what I used to do is I would like take these pieces of the schematic that I wanted to show my article and hand illustrate them and then add annotations on top of them and stuff like that, which worked, but it was a lot of work. But then I was like, well, KiCad's files are plain text. I can just parse those and display something myself with, you know, HTML canvas. And while that sounds simple, that is horrendously complicated.
Yeah.
And that led to a whole rabbit hole. And what we got out the other end was KiCanvas, which is a entire web renderer for KiCad files that reads them natively, doesn't require any like ahead of time work or anything. Just you point it at a KiCad file and it'll render it.
Yeah.
95% of the time it'll render it.
We've already used it for so many of our docs things already, and it is so nice. Like being able to link to a certain like, and you also made it so that links will work with it too. So if you just feed it a link to a certain like GitHub, even a commit, you know?
Yeah. So I made it where you can like link to like specific files in GitHub. And eventually I'm going to make it where you can link to specific components, you know, like that's called deep linking. And it's one of the major features I really need to actually get around to doing. But like, that's so useful, is being able to like link specifically to like a page or a component or a viewport and say like, look at this thing. Or if you're giving feedback to somebody, like that is like priceless.
Yeah, it super is. I use that for, there was someone in the Lumen PMP community who was like, hey, I have this, you know, this file, or I'm trying to replace a part on a board, and like they didn't know which one it was. And I managed to link them to the part. And I mean, you know, deep linking would be the way to do that fully. But I just said, here's this link, go to this from this commit of the board that you have. Like it was to a specific commit on GitHub.
Yeah.
And then I said, it's C7, click on C7. And they clicked on it and it lit up. And like, that's the part you replace, and it tells you what it is. And like,
yeah,
it's such a good documentation tool. But I'm curious, so like for some of the stuff that you did for like the wave generators that you have in some of your docs pages where you can actually see the wave and kind of play around with it. As far as I'm aware, you didn't turn into its own open source project. You didn't turn into its own kind of whole thing. It's just a little utility you built for your docs.
Uh-huh.
What made you decide to turn KiCanvas into a full open source project? Like, what's your criteria for being like, this thing I've made, I'm going to open source it, and I'm going to have X amount of maintenance and X amount of support, and like you're very explicit about that. What's your decision-making process for, you know, what does it ultimately become? Do I open source it? Do I support it? All that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, everything I do is open source. Some of it is in more digestible formats than others, but like, I think my criteria, like in the difference between like what I do in terms of like little interactive bits on documentation or in my articles, those are open source, but they're so small, right?
Yeah.
Like those are massively complicated bits of code and none of it's minimized. So if you go to my stuff and go to view source, you can go and look at what I did. So anyone can steal that. Please steal that. I don't care. So I think like for it to become like its own thing, it has to be, there has to be some utility beyond what I'm doing it for, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, KiCad has had direct utility for me, which was making my articles look better.
Yeah.
But it also had broad appeal of like, like being able to view KiCad files without having to download them and open them up is really awesome.
Yeah.
And being able to embed them into your documentation is also really awesome.
Yeah.
So it's just more about like, will anyone other than me find this particular thing useful? And is it generic enough that someone else is going to find it useful?
Is that the only thing? Because like, even if you make something, I mean, you only have so much time. Like if you make something that's useful, like other people might have found that wave tool useful. Definitely not as much as KiCanvas. Like obviously KiCanvas has way wider appeal, but is there a time where you decide, okay, I just can't take on another thing here. It might be useful, but I'm just going to kind of, you know, GLHF take the thing as it is on the source and not like do all of kind of the massaging and ushering of issue management and, you know, all the other open source things as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, that doesn't come into my calculus of whether or not I'm going to open source something or make something its own project.
Okay.
It might come into my calculus of whether or not I'm going to promote it or like talk about it very broadly.
Okay. Interesting.
But like generally speaking, like I don't feel the same obligation that I feel a lot of other open source maintainers feel about their stuff.
Okay.
And part of that is that like I'm jaded. And part of it's just like I burned out really hard when I was working at Google. And like since then I like I treat my joy in what I do as sacred. Yeah. And like, you know, if I release something open source, then it gets a bunch of issues and there's a bunch of, you know, people talking about it or whatever. And there's a lot of negativity. I just will work on it. I don't care. Like, like Key Canvas has bugs, right? Like there's things it doesn't work with and that's okay. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit here and stay up all night frustrated or angry or upset or stressed because it doesn't work right.
Right.
And I feel like I need to do something about it now. No, sure. Like I'll get around to it when I get around to it. And like no one's going to die. Like it'll be fine. Right. Like,
sure.
So like my whole attitude about open source is just like, I'm going to open source everything I can. I feel no need to keep anything I do secret. If someone else uses it and finds it useful, great. If someone else uses it and like runs into a problem and doesn't find it useful, I don't have to fix that for them.
Yeah.
They can fix it if they want to.
Right. It's provided right? Without warranty.
As is without warranty.
Yep.
Yeah.
For a reason.
Yep.
And I mean, of course, that changes when I like when I'm selling products, right? Sure. Like there's some obligation to support there.
Yeah.
But like it's still the same fundamental thing.
And you've given them the ability to fix it themselves by making it open source. Like if you just release some closed binary of a thing,
yeah,
and you're like, hey, this should work to invert a linked list or whatever, you know, some task and it doesn't work right, people don't have the ability to try and fix that thing, you know. But if you open it, it's like, well, you fixed the bug. Like, you know, if it's bugging you, spend the time to make it be what you want it to be and then roll it back if it's that important to you, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Your bug is not my bug, right? Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. There's a lot that can be said about open source and its sustainability and how people get paid to work on open source or don't get paid to work on open source. And it's complicated. Mm-hmm. But overall, my feelings are that, like, it's commons, right? Like, someone goes to a public park and they kindly plant some nice flowers. And then, you know, a week later, someone comes by and is like, oh, these flowers are dying. You should water them. It's like, no, you should water them. Like, get out of here.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. I hear that. That's a cool approach, you know? And like, I really like you saying, you know, the joy in what you do should be sacred. It's not worth it. You're doing it for fun. Like if it suddenly becomes not fun, it's like, okay, well, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, I'm putting it out here to help. And, you know, and that's it. That's the reason I'm putting it out there, is that you can take it on if you'd like. But, you know, you built it for yourself, first and foremost.
Yeah. And like, I'm not forcing anybody to use 99% of the open source projects that I right. create, right? Right? Like,
yeah,
you don't have to use Key Canvas. You can export a PDF.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to use any of my other projects.
Mm-hmm.
You can use other things. There's alternatives in almost every case, in which that's the great thing about open source.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I was going to ask you about this with Nox, because Nox is another project that you co-started, main maintainer. What was your exact... Did you start Nox?
Yeah, I started Nox. I started Nox when I was working at Google.
That's so cool. But people probably depend on Nox. But there are other tools that they could use instead of that. So like, what's the balance on that one? If someone comes in, does it feel different with something like that, where like people's CI probably depends on that, or not so much?
So yeah, I mean, Nox is an interesting case because like, it originated during my time at Google, and Google depends on it, right?
So right.
Like,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of Python code in Google that is tested using Nox.
Sure.
And there was always obligation to make sure that it worked for Google's case when I was working at Google.
Yeah.
And then when I left Google, I took the most hands-off possible approach to maintaining. I made like two people at Google maintainers of Nox before I left.
Yeah.
And then I also made like three people in the community maintainers of Nox when I left.
Cool.
And all I really am there for now is just to like, if someone needs like some divine guidance, I will respond to an issue or a pull request. But for the most part, like it got to the point where there were enough people that depended on it that like, there were people that could handle taking it on, right?
Sure.
Like,
yep.
I think your job as an open source maintainer is that as soon as there are enough people working on it to overwhelm you, that's when you need to be adding other maintainers so that they can't overwhelm you anymore,
right? Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't happen, then don't do it anymore.
Yeah, yep.
If no one else wants to step up and do the thing, then just use it for yourself and don't try to please everyone else.
Interesting. That's such a cool balance. And I think that's something that a lot of people have a really hard time with being open source maintainers. There's a great book called Building in Public. I forget the name of the author, but we'll put it in the show notes for the episode. it's almost kind of like an audit of a lot of open source maintainers and how do they get paid? What is their structure? You know, who's in charge? And like, it's a fascinating read. It's a really, really good book. And I think a lot of people, at least based on my experience there and anecdotally from other maintainers, it's different from your approach there. And I think their problems come from obviously money, but, you know, feeling a lot of pressure. And if you can find a way to alleviate some of that, you're going to have a better time being an open source maintainer.
Exactly.
So that's a lot of the software stuff. I want to get into the hardware.
Let's get into hardware.
So you did software for a good long time. And then you said, you know what? I'm going to start a synthesizer company. How did that come to be? What's Winterbloom? Why'd you start it? Give me that arc.
Sure. So Winterbloom is a company that I started in February of 2020. Again, I am very good at timing. Very good at timing. Renowned for my timing. I started getting into synthesizers because I was bored of just writing software. And I wanted to get back in touch with music and tried to kind of find a way to tie all that together. Mm-hmm. And so I got into synthesizers and then I was like, well, I got into modular synthesizers, which is like the kind of synthesizers you get into when you have way too much disposable income, which is what I had when I worked at Google.
Yeah.
And I started finding myself wanting modules to exist that didn't exist. Because like modular is like Lego, where you get a bunch of different pieces and you kind of hook them together to make your own synthesizer that does whatever you want it to do. And there's all these little niche makers, all these little independent companies that make these. And there's also some larger music tech companies that make modules. But they're all very, very unique. Like some of them serve the same purpose, but they do it in a slightly different way.
Right.
Anyways, started finding myself wanting modules to exist in certain ways. And so I just started making them for myself. And then I made one that I thought was kind of neat. And I was like, well, maybe other people would want this. So I was like, maybe I'll make some and sell it. And I did that. And a couple years later, here we are.
Yeah.
It's mostly just been about bringing things into existence that I wanted to exist and seeing if other people wanted that. And if they did, selling it.
How has the transition, because like a big thing that I think about a lot with Opulo is the change of you have this open source thing with no warranty and play with it if you want. And then now you take money for it and it's a very different relationship with the thing. How was your jump from your focus on open software and open hardware to, well, now I've taken your money for it. How was that transition starting Winterbloom and like the first time you started selling that hardware? Did you feel a shift? Like, did it feel different now that there's money for it? Like, what did that feel like?
Yeah, there was definitely a shift. Everything changes when, like, you sell somebody something physical that they might need to return or repair or exchange, right? Mm. That becomes such a different world.
Yeah.
And I think overall, my experience with supporting my products has been positive. Mm-hmm. I haven't really had any customers that are like super obnoxious. And if they are, I'll just return their money and then just not sell them things anymore.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
And like, it's one of those things where like, you're not going to please everybody. Mm-hmm. Like you might be able to make a small amount of people very happy. And I guess like my whole like approach to support and like what it means as a company to sell something physical is just like, I'll do what I can within reason. And then beyond that, you're on your own. Like, worst case scenario, I refund you and you go away, right? Like, and there's actually something liberating about that, right?
Yeah.
Like, with open source, it's like, you can get that one person who keeps using your thing and reporting bugs constantly and constantly bothering you on issue trackers, emails, forums, stalking you across multiple Discords. Like, that's a hard person to kind of just like, it's hard to like, just cut them off, right?
Right, right.
But like, what's amazing about selling a physical good is that you have a tangible thing, which is, here's your refund, leave me the heck alone.
Right. Like, yeah. You don't get to bug me anymore after I refund your money.
Yeah. So like, to me, like, it's understanding that those are the stakes, right? Like, I mean, obviously, like, I don't want to be a dick to my customers.
Sure.
I want to have a good, positive relationship with my customers because they're also in my community.
Right.
But like, at the same time, I don't want to waste my time, my energy on trying to make someone happy who is just not going to be happy. Right.
It's like an escape hatch. You know, the Pareto rule, if, you know, 20% of people cause 80% of the issues. And if you have a way to these people that are just like, it's just not for them. They didn't like the thing. It's just not working out for them. You have that escape hatch to be like, you know what? Never mind. You got the thing for free. You know, we're done. You know, this didn't work out. I could see that approach for sure.
Yeah. And like the whole, like, you're only going to make like a handful of small people very happy and you're not ever going to make everyone happy.
Yeah.
Like that comes from this book that I really love called Shit Happens, which is about the audio company Shit Audio, which is S-C-H-I-I-T. That's literally what they named the company.
I've never heard of that before. That's great.
They make great products. So they make everything in the US and they like are very upfront and straightforward about what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love their hardware.
And the author talks about like support, you know, like it's like the last thing I want to do is sell a product to someone who isn't going to like it.
Right.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't want to make a product that sucks, but also no product is going to please everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to sell something to someone who's going to hate it.
Right.
And like that really stuck with me where it's like you could go to some products on the Winterbloom's website and it'll be like, if you're looking for this thing, this ain't it.
Yeah. We sometimes people will call like they'll send us an email on sales at Opula or something. And you can tell from the kind of thing they're trying to do. It's like the Lumen is not for you.
Right.
If you get it, it's not going to do what you want. This is not the thing you should buy. And like we tell them that because we don't want them to have a bad time with it. The point isn't to make money. It's to solve the problem. And the more you do that, the better.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm uninterested in causing someone, you know, anguish just so I can make some money.
Right,
I'm uninterested in creating more waste by shipping something and then having to have to ship it back or throw it away. Like I'm uninterested in that. I just want to make things that make people happy. And I don't want anything to do with trying to hard sell someone on something that isn't going to make them happy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's a fool's errand to do that. That's interesting. Okay. That's a book to read. I like that ethos a lot. So yeah, Winterbloom, you design all the hardware, you make some of it in-house, some of it you outsource, you do all your QC, programming, calibration, packaging, shipping, support, docs, the whole nine is like Thea and Maggie.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's really cool what you guys pull off. We do a similar thing where we ship hardware. So I kind of want to compare and contrast of like, what's your process? You get a cha-ching, you know, Shopify order ding or whatever, and you have to ship a synth.
Uh-huh.
What happens? What's that pipeline of like, you have a piece of open hardware, you need to get it out the door. What are all the processes? And I know there's a lot of stuff here and we will have you on for other episodes where I want to get more into the weeds of this, but like, what's the broad strokes of like how that works? What happens?
Yeah. Oh my God. So much things.
Mm-hmm.
Like even excluding all the product development stuff, like, you know, someone orders a product that we already have.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
Well, generally for most products, we don't keep a whole lot of finished units around. We generally produce finished units in like batches of 20 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So if we get an order and we haven't produced like a batch of 20 or so in a while, We do that, right? Like we'll do a batch of 20, and that usually takes like a day or two.
Yeah.
So like for most of our products, they're already PCB assemblies, right? They already have all the surface mount parts on them.
Yeah.
So we start from that, and what we do is we go and we test them. So we have a test jig and a custom test program for each product that we go through and run automated tests on to test that circuit assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we go to what we call stuffing, which is where we put all the through-hole parts on it.
Yep.
And then soldering. So then I solder all the through-hole parts.
Yep.
And then that goes to what we call dressing, which is where I put the faceplate on and the nuts and any like knobs and other little finishing touches. And then from there, we go to the final quality check, which, you know, generally is like I hook it up to a rack and put audio through it or like play with it and make sure that like every product has like a series of steps that we follow for the final QC to make sure that like it sounds and works the way that it should.
Right.
And then wrapping and then boxing and then allocation and then shipping.
Yeah.
So a lot. There's a lot. A lot of things go into motion.
No kidding. Especially with something like that test jig, which is Hubble, the project that you made for that. And you have to write a different test program for each thing. And like some of, correct me if I'm wrong, but some, if not all of your modules require some kind of calibration, right? Like you're actually hooking it up to a scope, you're doing a cal, you're saving the calibration value. That's all product in and of itself that you had to make.
Yeah. I mean, like you build two products, right? You build the product and you build the thing to test the product,
yep,
right?
Yep. Yep.
So Hubble is like this generalization of a lot of the product specific test jigs that you'll see. Sparkman has a nice write-up about it. Adafruit's posted about theirs, you know, a little bit. Mm-hmm. But like all of theirs are very small and very product specific, right? And most of the time they're like, you know, for dev boards are like you know, making sure all the pins operate and all that stuff.
Sure.
For us, like, we're shipping things that interface with analog electronics. So we're like, we got to do a little bit more.
Yeah. Right? Yep. Makes
sense. And the hardware required to do that is actually pretty complicated.
Yeah.
And so I didn't like the idea. Like, I did initially have a separate test jig for our, like, our first three products, but I quickly started to hate that. and so, like, I didn't like the idea of, like, having to redo it every time for every module. So I came up with this idea, and we call it Hubble. It's a test jig. It's, like, based on the generic levered bed of nails test jig that you can, like, get for $60 on eBay or something that's made of, like, orange Bakelite.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a couple of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of based out of that idea. But what I've done is, like, I've made a motherboard that has the brains and a bunch of analog circuitry for, like, you know, basically has an analog front end for creating all the voltages that we need to control the module under test, and also a bunch of stuff for recording voltages from it, and also switching and routing so that we can route it to our test instruments, like our 6.5-digit multimeter for calibration, or our function generator, or our oscilloscope. And I'm actually hoping to get rid of the function generator and oscilloscope with the next revision and just have that incorporated into the brain itself so that it doesn't have to hand that off to another instrument.
Oh, really? You're just going to have like a crazy ADC that does effectively what the oscilloscope did already? How are you going to do that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Basically that, okay, right? Like, okay. We don't need super high resolution on the oscilloscope. Again, we're working with audio rate stuff, so we don't have to like really get too big into like high bandwidth. But yeah, and same for the function generator, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot that we can get away with just because we're working in audio rate. But yeah, like Hubble has 16 plus or minus 10 volt analog outs and analog ins.
Wow.
So we have that motherboard basically. And that just looks like a big fancy dev board with a bunch of analog stuff on it.
Sure.
And then what sits on top of that, like a big Arduino shield, we call them lenses, is an actual adapter for each product. So that's just a board with, you know, the header pins to sit on top of the motherboard, and then a bunch of pogo pins facing upwards so that the module can be placed on top of it, and then the pressure can be applied with the lever.
Yep.
And those lenses are what connect up the signals from Hubble to the actual device under test.
Sure.
And then we control all of it through a Python script, and that's how we do our tests. We write a bunch of Python scripts to do it, and then at the end, we print out a receipt that says how things went.
That's so cool.
I
love that. I love those bespoke test jigs. And do you have sufficient hardware on that main board that you don't have to add like any auxiliary hardware onto the lens? Like maybe you have one module that needs, I don't know, some crazy light sensor or something. I don't know. So, but something that you might not have put on there. Could you add extra hardware onto the lens to support a weird module? Or is most of it pretty much just baked into that main controller?
Yeah. So that absolutely is something that happens, right? Like, okay. I was very inspired by like the Super Nintendo where like they had a bunch of extra chips on the cartridge to help certain games.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so like for the most part, anything that's going to be really expensive is already on the motherboard.
Okay.
So like the expensive ADCs, the expensive, you know, op amps to drive those and the expensive DACs and so on and so forth. Those are all already on the main board. On the lens, we generally have like things like extra analog switches or multiplexers if we need to switch signals. And like, you know, for products that have USB or need to be programmed via SWID, we will usually put the USB connector on the lens and the Cortex debug header on the lens.
Oh, cool. Okay.
There's a permanent J-Link that lives inside of Hubble's base that has a cable that comes up. You can just plug into the lens.
Cool.
For those. Yeah, the inside of Hubble is like little bottom area is so janky. It's like
I love it. I think you tweeted a video or something about the inside of it, and like it's cool. I really like the inside of it. Like it, everything there makes sense. You know, you got like three USB hubs or just one, I guess.
But yeah, it's just one USB hub, and like there's a power supply that's just held together like with one screw in there.
I love it.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah. It's very janky underneath the covers. So
doesn't it also, like, it will log all of the calibration data? So if, like, a customer wants to flash their cal, can't they do that in some way as well? Like, you also make that the cal data available that you generate at Winterbloom?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's less, I guess, like, that's less the hardware doing that and more just our test scripts do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, our test library will save basically measurements to a JSON file, and then we can upload that. And then we have nice little web MIDI based settings editors that can go and look for that file in our backup bucket.
Yeah.
If it finds that file, it will let people like restore their original like calibration if they want to do that.
That's so cool. That's awesome. So we're about to release a new version of firmware for feeders. And that made me really want to ask you about this too, because you have firmware that runs on your modules. What is your release structure for your hardware and the firmware that goes onto the modules? And like, how do you communicate it? How do people find out that there's a new firmware release? When do you decide to do a firmware release? Like, what is your release cadence for like a new version? Like, you just came out with, was it Castor and Pollux 2? You just had an update to it. Like, what does that look like for Winterbloom?
My strategy is that like, I want to make it as easy as possible for people to update their firmware.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to make it as easy as possible for someone to recover from a bad firmware.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of strategies there. And so like, by doing that, I allow myself to release firmware whenever the heck I want.
Cool.
And release it fast and often.
Yep.
So the idea with my modules is that I make sure there's a bootloader on there that can be talked to via USB.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what, even if I write garbage firmware that sucks, they can recover it through a USB bootloader.
Yep.
So that's stage one. You know, the other stage is that any kind of calibration or, you know, stuff that I create when I'm testing the module, it gets saved to Flash that might in some way get overwritten. That's recoverable somehow.
Okay.
And, you know, that goes back to like the Web MIDI tool where you can restore your calibration, right?
Sure. Yep.
That hasn't happened as far as I know. But in the event that like, you know, there's a bad firmware and it corrupts all the calibration data, like it should be a one button to fix that, right?
Yep. Yep.
The other thing is releasing often and working with people in our Discord that are very enthusiastic and technical minded to test that before I release it is great.
Mm-hmm.
But also just like being proactive and fixing issues. It's so wild to me that like there's a lot of music tech out there, a lot of synthesizers and just, you know, music related gear that never receives a firmware update. And like it's never intended to receive a firmware update.
Right.
And it blows my mind.
Yeah, Lucian and I were just talking about this like last night of like there are some things that when I don't know, probably mostly it's like military or like some cars and stuff. They're never like the firmware they ship is like intended to be on it for forever, like bugs and all, you know, like,
yeah,
it's that's just what it get. What was the example?
Yeah,
it
was like your 96 Honda Accord isn't getting an update, Steven.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. like there's no method to update the, you know, the ECU on that thing. Like that's it's baked. That's done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't like that. Right.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
You know, and part of it is also like it's open source and I want people to be able to do whatever they want to with it. So
right.
Like being able to load firmware and update firmware is critical to anything that I release that has firmware.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I try to make it as easy as possible to update. I try to make it possible to recover from a bad update.
Mm-hmm.
And then that lets me have the freedom to release firmware in whatever way that I want.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And people can choose to update or not. And, you know, the way that I tend to communicate firmware updates is usually just through our socials and through our Discord.
Okay.
Of course, a lot of people don't ever look at those or they'll miss it.
Sure.
So for something that like might be really messed up, you know, I'll use an email list of customers that I know purchased it.
Sure.
And we can also send out a repair notice to our resellers and say, hey, like, we noticed this thing in some of these things. Just be aware of this if you get any customer feedback on it.
Do you ever have to consider, like, what minor revision of a product someone might have is? Like, for us, we have to, when communicating with customers, we have to think about, do they have the Lumen V305, the V302? Like, what will they need to upgrade from and what can they upgrade to?
So because I'm an absolute just unhinged person, we have Castor and Pollux and we also have Castor and Pollux 2.
Mm-hmm.
And Castor and Pollux and Castor and Pollux 2 are essentially the same thing, except Castor and Pollux 2 has a sort of reimagined user interface. It's got bigger knobs. It's a little bit more what we call like performance oriented. It's easier for you to twiddle around with while you're playing music.
Sure.
Castor and Pollux 1 and Castor and Pollux 2 are different hardware. They got most of the same bits, right? Like they both have a SAMD21. They both have the same analog circuitry.
Mm.
But there's enough differences there where if I had made separate firmware for Castor and Pollux 2 that was incompatible with Castor and Pollux 1, no one would have batted an eye.
Yeah.
But I can't leave well enough alone. So Casman Pollux 1 and 2 run the same firmware.
Wow.
So in that firmware code, we have like two completely separate sets of configuration for version 1 and version 2.
Oh, no way. That's a good way to handle it.
Does it know based on which like chip it's flashed to, or like how does it know which one to use?
So this was another thing where like I needed it to work even if like all the configuration data got corrupted, right?
Right.
Like, so what I did was for Castor and Pollux 2, we tied one of the extra pins on the MCU to ground.
Yep, yep.
And then at startup, we configure that pin as pull up and we read it, and then that determines the hardware revision.
That's so and cool. Then,
yeah, and then from there, it can pick, you know, okay, I'm going to use this spy configuration. I'm going to use, you know, this I2C configuration. I'm going to use these pins for this stuff, and so on and so forth.
Wow. That's so cool. So you, and obviously you had the flash space to, and it's not like you're rewriting the whole firmware. You probably just have like a different define file for like which pins go to what things, and maybe some configuration data. So like it probably wasn't even that much overhead to include both of them in the same file, right?
It was a little tricky because like we can't just use defines, right? Because it has to have the configuration for both firmware versions,
right?
I mean, both hardware versions in there.
Yep.
So some of it was like changing drivers so that they don't just use static defined configuration, right? They use configuration struct that's passed in.
Okay.
So there's some overhead to that, but it's not very much, right? Like it's not super, super terrible.
Sure.
There are some fun things that like kind of bit me later on where like I ended up swapping which pulse channel goes to which oscillator.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, I was accidentally treating oscillator 1 as oscillator 2 and oscillator 2 as oscillator 1, but only in like a specific circumstance, which called some weird bugs. But overall, I'm very happy that I did that, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't want to leave anybody behind, but I also want to be able to make improvements to what I put out there.
Right.
Yep. And this was the best way that I could think to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting way to think about it, because we run into a similar thing of like, we don't want to leave folks behind if we have a new firmware update. We just made improvements to like centralized homing for the Lumen. And like, we rolled that back to machines with rollers instead of just linear rails. It's worth taking the time to make a new cut of the firmware for, and those have to be different Marlin builds. They just have to be. So we had to make those two separate firmware images, but you know, you want to still be constantly releasing new things and like people get the version that they do at that time and then try and make it as easy to upgrade as possible. But sometimes it's really hard to do that, you know, especially when there's a million different configurations that gets very complicated very quickly.
Yeah. And like ultimately it comes down to legacy, right?
Yeah.
It's legacy and like how much is it worth it to you and your customers to support that legacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the cost?
Right. Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, you know, you have to cut a separate version for people with rollers instead of linear rails, right? At a certain point, you know, there might be an inflection point where it makes more sense to just offer existing users a discounted upgrade to linear rails
right.
than it does to perform on the maintenance required to keep supporting firmware or software for it.
Sure.
And you obviously haven't reached that inflection point. Otherwise, that would be what you were doing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But like, it's one of those things where like legacy doesn't have to be a burden. It's an opportunity.
Yeah.
And how you handle that is going to ultimately like determine how people view you as a company.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Totally.
And the worst possible thing that you can do is just ignore it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, the thought of when we made the improvements for 3.1, which is when we cut in the linear rails, which also happens to be your mod that we rolled into mainline, like another thing that we haven't gotten to yet. But it was cool to be like, oh, wow, I can. It's not just this subset of customers that have linear rails that will get this. Like, it took me 2.5 hours to test it and validate it and make sure that all the changes that I made also work for older versions. And we have a bunch of them here that I could test on. Like, that's cool. I just made everyone's thing better. You know, like if you can ship a software update, all this existing hard. Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's a pretty high bar to decide to not do that, depending on how much overhead and support you need for that software update for older hardware. But like, if you can, you're just making the entire fleet better. That's such a boon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is an interesting thing to have to decide when you cut that off.
Absolutely. That's, yeah, such a challenge.
It is tricky. So you also mentioned that your community will test firmware updates and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle contributions to Winterbloom stuff? Like not only hardware, but firmware? Do you get PRs? If you do, how do you handle them? Are most things issues? Like, is it kind of open source that Thea makes and puts it out there, or is it do other people put stuff in?
Yeah, it's really interesting because like one of the things that's super different between a product like the Lumen and things like I make, which are like synthesizers, is that like the audience has a completely different relationship with the product, right?
Right. Yeah.
So like most of the people that buy musical instruments buy them to play them, right? Like buy them to making music with them, right? Sure. And, you know, while instruments themselves can be works of art, they are ultimately used to make other works of art in a different medium, right? So a lot of the time, like, the people that use my products are never going to contribute to open source or, like, even think about the idea of contributing back, right? Like, they might send a feature request, which is wonderful. I welcome them.
Yeah.
But they might, you know, say, this would be neat. And my favorite thing is when someone comes into our Discord and they're like, it would be neat if you could, if this thing was a thing. And then someone else is like, oh, I can make that happen, right? Like, because it's like this interesting intersection. But there is a set of users who are both technically minded and musicians. So like, they are on both sides of that fence, just like me. Mm-hmm. And they do have the skills and the desire to contribute.
Right.
And my whole thing is that I'm 100% open to any contributions. There haven't been a lot of contributions directly to the hardware after the fact, right? Like, once I release something, like, people don't generally, like, send me a pull request to change, like, the KiCad file or anything like that. What I'll mostly get is people, like, saying, oh, in the next revision, you could try this. You know, like, with Castor Pollux 1 and Castor Pollux 2, it's like, people gave a lot of feedback about, oh, I want bigger knobs. And it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
What I more get is that, like, I can share something that I'm working on with my community and get really good feedback.
Okay.
I think that that's a key difference between, like, open hardware, open software. It's like, open hardware is something where, like, you get the most of the contributions before you release something.
Right.
With software is you get most of the contributions after you release something, or at least in this case.
Yeah.
And I've definitely gotten pull requests for firmware and stuff, which I love. I absolutely love getting pull requests for firmware stuff. It means a lot to me. But, like, you know, most of it's just like, come to our Discord and talk, right?
Yep.
That's a contribution. That's a big contribution.
Right.
And all the wonderful things that come out of that are really interesting.
Yeah.
And part of my whole ethos with Winterbloom and open source in general is that I don't necessarily need people to contribute back to what I'm putting out there. What brings me satisfaction and what is really satisfying is when people take what I put out there and they create something of their own. That's the ultimate goal, right? One of the things that has just been so delightful over the last couple of years with Winterbloom is seeing people in my Discord that have joined and bought a Winterbloom module and were like, oh, this is cool. And then 6 months later, they design their own and they're selling it. And I'm like,
wow,
that is amazing.
That's cool.
Every time I see that, I am just blown away. And like, that's happened several times now. And I'm stoked. I think it's so cool. And if we never put out another product or if we close up shop tomorrow, that is the legacy for me. Right. The legacy is those other people who saw what we did, learned from it, and created their own things.
Right. Wow. That's so cool. And also the fact that there is the Venn diagram of module, like, electronic music enthusiasts and electrical engineers is has some overlap, but isn't huge. But the overlap of electrical engineers and pick and place enthusiasts is almost a circle.
Yeah.
You know, when that does happen, it's like, oh, wow, this moved someone so much. And they also happen to be in this sliver of overlap and they still took it. And that means so much more, you know, that it's in that smaller category of people. That's just got to feel incredible seeing that influence someone making their own thing like that.
Yeah. I mean, seeing someone's oh, I've never used KiCad before. I've never designed my own circuit. Going from that to I built a whole thing is so cool.
Yeah. That's sick. I'm curious if you've ever dealt with cloning with any of your modules, any of your hardware. Have you ever had someone clone the design and make it and sell it on their own? And is that something you've ever experienced before with Winterbloom?
That is an interesting question. And it's an interesting question in the context of music tech as well.
Yeah.
So first of all, on a commercial scale, no one has cloned Winterbloom stuff.
Okay.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
I have no strong feelings one way or another on that one.
Yep.
Whenever someone starts an open hardware company, I love to ask them the question of, what do you do when someone else starts selling your product?
Yeah, and that's exactly why I'm asking you that right now. Because it's so interesting to see what people think.
Right. The answer to that question is the fundamental existential question of your company, right?
Yep.
And it's, what do you do, right? Yep.
The great way to put your money where your mouth is.
Stand by the... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That really determines if you're truly open or not.
Yeah.
On a commercial scale, we've not been cloned. The thing about music tech, though, or the thing about music instruments in general, mm-hmm. is that this whole enchilada is built on copying, cloning, and stealing.
Right.
That's also the case for music itself. The yeah. whole thing is built on a mountaintop of stealing other stuff from other people. And like, I'm being glib, but everything is inspired by something else. Nothing is made in a vacuum.
Sure.
You look at the most successful guitar of all time, the Fender Stratocaster, has been cloned endlessly by hundreds of different companies. And Fender is still around and they're still selling the Stratocaster, right?
Yep.
And it's not even open source hardware. Yeah. It's just there.
It's
right?
just there, yeah.
And they're doing just fine.
And in fact, Fender has thrived because the Stratocaster got cloned.
Right, yep.
Which is so interesting. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to music tech, like that's something you have to really wrestle with.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, someone else is going to copy it.
Yep.
And no matter what you do, you're going to be inspired by someone else's work.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a pedal brand that I like a lot called JHS Pedals. And Joshua got his start modifying Boss pedals and selling those, right?
Cool.
He'd get the Boss pedal. He'd make his little circuit bends to it, and he'd sell it.
Yep.
And then eventually he said, well, it's dumb for me to buy the pedals from Boss at full price and mod them and then resell them.
Yeah.
So I'll make my own pedals with all that just in place. So he got started by cloning, right?
Yep.
So like, there's so much of that in this industry.
Yeah.
It's just, it's inevitable.
Yep. Yep.
There's cases of that being transformative, like in the case of JHS.
Mm-hmm.
And there's cases of that being kind of a dick move.
Yeah.
And that's companies like Behringer, which, you know, they use exploitative labor and massive reverse engineering efforts to clone hardware that's still in production and undercut people.
Yep.
And not make any material changes to it.
Mm.
And like, that sucks.
Yep.
And people, you know, they'll sell some, that's fine.
Mm.
And people will debate that endlessly.
Yeah.
But it's just a reality of this industry. And like the Spark Fund CEO, God, I wish I could remember his name. I really
Nathan
should remember
Seidel.
His name. Nathan. Yeah. Yes, Nathan. Nathan had an amazing talk years ago where he said, if you have a successful product, it will get cloned.
Yep.
That's just it.
Yep. I watch that talk once a month. I love that talk.
Cloning is going to happen whether you like it or not.
Yep.
There's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Apple can't stop AirPods from being cloned.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Like, my response is that you can't control whether or not it's going to happen. You can only control how you respond to it.
Right.
And for us, for Winterbloom, my response to it is enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like last week, someone posted a picture on Instagram and they were like, I just stayed up all night building this. And they posted a picture of a module.
Yeah.
And at first glance, Maggie and I thought it was just someone who had built a Neptune kit because we sell kits. But we looked at it a little more closely. And it didn't say Neptune. It said Poseidon. And the font was different. And it was laid out differently. Like the font was different, but like all the labels were in the same spot and everything.
Yep.
And they made one from scratch.
Wow.
Like they took out open source files. They ordered the board. They ordered the parts. We open sourced the faceplate shape. So the shape of it and the holes and stuff.
Yeah.
But because like trademark stuff is tricky and all that stuff. The actual artwork that's on the faceplate, we don't release.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes it better for everyone. Because if someone just wants to order one for themselves, they don't have to worry about stripping stuff off of it.
Oh, sure.
Legal issues.
Yeah.
So that's what they did. They did that. And they also went to the effort of like putting some labels on it for themselves.
That's cool.
And when we realized that, like, I just start cracking up. And I'm like, that's so cool. Repost it right now. Like, it's so cool. You know, someone went through the effort to do that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And we love this to the extent of like, you know, a few months back, we tweeted out like, steal this module. And we linked to a full self-sourcing guide for one of our modules where it walks you through every step of ordering the boards. And there's a full BOM with notes and ratings and MPNs on DigiKey, Mouser, and LCSC. There's substitution notes. There's everything that you would need to make it yourself. And we told people to steal it.
Yep.
And it is so funny because it's actually full circle, because the first product that I did that for was actually a product I developed out of spite and cloned from another manufacturer.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
And this goes back to like, you know, ultimately, I'm not really selling synthesizers. I'm selling a brand. I'm selling a concept. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Winterbloom is a concept of openness and transparency and of like trying to at least be decent people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other brands out there that have more products, that maybe have better products, but their brand is that they're a bunch of jerks.
Yeah.
And people don't like that.
Right. Yeah.
There is this company called Centrotech, who's run by an absolute jerk. And someone in my Discord posted a link to one of their products. I was like, oh, I really like this. This is exactly what I need. But Centrotech is the only person selling this.
Yep.
And it was like a super basic utility module. It's like a buffer,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And I was like, give me 3 weeks. And 3 weeks later, I had helium and hydrogen ready to ship.
Wait, that's what they are? They came from?
They came from that.
That's insane. I didn't realize
Nuked.
That.
And I also, awesome. Did it, I also did it better. So I used like higher quality components.
Sure.
And also mine has LEDs and his doesn't, so me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a beautiful product.
Yeah.
And then I intentionally priced it $10 less than his.
Oh, that's such a dunk. I love that.
So effectively, I cloned his product.
Yeah.
I mean, like, again, it's a super basic circuit, right? It's just a buffer.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, I cloned like firmware and, right, you know, some crazy complicated hardware. This is a very basic utility.
Yeah.
I cloned it. I made it better. I sell it for less just to spite him. And that's this industry working the way that it's always worked.
Yeah.
And open source has nothing to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, because none of that is open aside from what you choose to do with after you're done with the design.
Exactly.
That continues to enforce that cloning is not a function of being open or not. It's a function of a product's popularity and interest. Like if people want to make it themselves, they just will. Like
exactly.
Remember when hoverboards were super popular in like 2016, 2017?
Oh yeah.
Always yeah.
Wanted one.
There was a million different brands you could buy it from. It was the same thing on the inside effectively because you buy one, you take it apart. It's not rocket science. And even if it is,
yeah,
there's a lot of smart people that can figure out what's controlling that thing. And then you just make another one. Like, yeah, it's always going to happen.
Yes. This comes back to like the point of open source, mm-hmm, is empowerment. The point of open source is changing the power dynamic,
yep,
between a creator and a consumer.
Yep.
And that's true of open source software. It's true of open source hardware. It's what I do when I open source something is I give away my power,
mm-hmm,
my exclusivity to understand, to build, to repair, to replace, to create from, mm-hmm, right? Like that is what open source does.
Yeah.
It makes it where I'm no longer the gatekeeper.
Yep.
I'm no longer the only one who will sell you this thing, who can fix this thing, who can understand it.
Yeah.
And that is so antithetical to the way that a lot of commercialization in Western countries is happening, where like you buy a game and you don't even actually own the game, no, right? You're basically just renting it for a really long time.
Yeah. Yes.
Or and even with physical goods, where it's like, oh, you bought, you know, an iPhone, but like, you know, Apple has tried multiple times to make it illegal to root it, right?
Yep,
to
yep,
like jailbreak it, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, no.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I want to own the things that I have.
Yeah.
And with software, I want to own the things that I use. I want to have the power, the permission, the yep, right,
yep,
to understand, dissect, repair, mm-hmm, replace. Because otherwise, it's just trash.
Yeah.
You've just given me trash.
You don't own it. That's what it comes down to for me more than anything, is like, it's about ownership. Like when you don't share the source, you are, like you said, the repair, the replacement parts, the understanding of how it works, you're keeping to yourself, you're owning it. But then when you open source it, you are relinquishing pure ownership, and you still have ownership. You still have the agency to work on the design and work on the docs and all that stuff, but you're also giving it to everybody else. You're relinquishing the ownership of the idea of the product, not just that physical unit or a distribution of the binary. And that's what it means to own something. When you have full autonomy of it, you don't own, you know, a game that you have only via software. Like that could get nuked. You know, they can turn that off. That's not ownership. Streaming something on a streaming service is not ownership. You know, you don't have that movie. It's the same kind of thing. It can be removed at any point, and that's, you don't own that thing. You really don't. It's like what Lewis Rossman says a lot about, like, you know, if you can't repair it, you can't own it kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, and that also leads us great into the third chunk I have here, which is about your involvement in open advocacy, which is a huge part of what you do. Like, you put your money where your mouth is. You know, you talk a lot about open source and you also execute by shipping open hardware and open software, but you're kind of supporting it as an idea is, I mean, you're literally the president of Oshawa. You're also very much in that scope of things. You know, you're, you know, what, advisory to the Python board? What's your role there? Like, you have your hands in so many of like the advocacy things as well.
Yeah, yeah. I eat my own words, as you said. Yeah.
I didn't mean it like that.
No, it's true. It's true, though. Like alphabet soup, right?
Yeah.
I don't know at what point I became an open source advocate, someone on the ideology side of things.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know, man. Like, it's like I said, like when you asked me, like when I first contributed to open source and what motivated me to do that, like, it just made sense.
Yeah.
Like, I never really questioned it, right? Like when I was started.
Right.
And then I started to question it and I'm like, why don't people do open source? Why? Like, what the heck?
Mm. This must have been like a natural progression for you then.
Yeah, it was.
It was the right thing to do.
It very much was, right? It was just like, well, yeah, like I learned, like the whole reason that I'm able to do any of this crap is because someone else open sourced something that I learned from.
Right.
So like, yeah, like of course I'm going to push for more open stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where things came around to me being more involved with organizations and things like that is where like I kind of got myself into trouble by being an effective technical communicator. So being able to write like quickly gets you people asking, hey, do you want to do this thing? And then you say, oh yeah, sure. And then suddenly you're like, oh, I'm on the board of directors.
That's great.
Yeah. So it's really weird.
Yeah.
And it's so funny that people are like, oh, Thea, you do so much advocacy stuff. And I feel like I don't actually do anything. You know, because like it sounds so fancy to be like, oh, I'm the president of open hardware. I mean, like that's stretching the truth a little bit, but like, and like, oh, I have code on Mars. And just like, it feels like one of those brags that's like technically true, like ultimately meaningless. So like, I guess like there's some degree of imposter syndrome where I'm like, I don't actually do anything, but I know that I actually do.
Yeah.
I do know that like people have told me that like, you know, my work has encouraged them or helped them or, you know, been in some way useful to them in their journey of open source, be it hardware or software.
Yeah.
And like, that's what I do it for, right? Like, that's the whole point.
Yep.
Like, obviously, like, I want a better world for all of us, but ultimately, I just want people to be able to find happiness in the empowerment that open source brings, right?
Yep.
Because I think there is joy in not taking everything in the world at face value and interrogating it and learning about it.
Right.
And you can't do that if everything is closed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can't pick it apart and check out the guts. And I mean, the Lumen project would not be what it is if not for you. Like I so frequently go to you, not only like directly asking you, but also like seeing how you operate in certain ways as guidance for how to approach, you know, handling open hardware. You know, I use you as a North Star for a lot of stuff. So like definitely, at least from this project, 100%, you know, you've had that influence and, you know, I think also a lot of it is just you are consistent and intelligent about talking about these things. And you're also not afraid to talk about them. And people look to you for that kind of thing. That's where I think a lot of that advocacy comes from, is just having you wrote the letter in response to Prusa. Super, super well written, very thoughtful. Like a lot of people read that. And taking the time and the effort to write that kind of thing, I think that's where a lot of that advocacy comes from. And those are very tangible things. You know, you're spending the time to think critically about it and write it. And, you know, it affects people. Like, I know so many people that read that and had a reaction, myself included, of like, what does this mean, and challenging thinking behind it. And I think that's where a lot of it comes from. As an objective person, not in your brain, who could experience the imposter syndrome, you definitely are. Like, you are definitely advocating for open source and doing a lot.
Oh man,
no imposter.
Yeah.
This is funny because like I'm crying a little bit because it was very sweet of you to say a lot of those things. But I'm also laughing because you kind of said that like the way that I do advocacy is by being loud.
I will amend that to say the way advocacy is done is being loud. Like,
I mean, like. Like, I mean, it's okay. Like, I accept that. That is a thing that I accept. Like, I've been accused of being a lot of things, trust me, but I've never been accused of being quiet.
Yeah. I think the best advocates are loud. I mean, you have to be to be trying to say a thing that, you know, you're trying to convince people or, you know, share an idea, being loud is the best way to do that, you know?
But I mean, you're right. Like, to be effective at advocacy, you have to be knowledgeable. You have to be consistent. You have to be believable.
Yeah.
And you have to be good at communicating. Mm-hmm. And this is stuff I learned doing developer advocacy at Google, right? I mean, that's true if you're trying to be an advocate for an ideology like open source or a movement like open source, or if you're trying to be an advocate for a product, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, one of the things that, you know, was hammered into my skull when I was learning developer advocacy was that developers hate marketing and they can smell it a mile away. That's not entirely true. Developers are susceptible to marketing. And if you think you aren't, I have bad news for you.
Yep.
But also, it is true that people, not just developers, people in general, will respond and resonate and understand a person who is relatable, who is honest, who is consistent. Mm-hmm. And it makes a huge difference that I'm not out there every other day saying something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also good that I'm not out there every day being mean to everybody, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's trying to be believable and relatable and also meet people where they are, right?
Yep.
And I love open source. I think everything should be open source, but I also am a practical person and I understand that open source isn't the correct choice for every situation.
Yep. Yep.
And especially when we think about the social aspect of open source. And seeing a lot of my fellow open source maintainers get burned out because of the social expectations around open source, I understand why people often take a step back or stop doing open source.
Yeah.
And my thing is to respect that and understand that and advocate for us to change socially how we view open source and how we view volunteerism in open source.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
And commercialism in open source.
Yeah, exactly.
So are.
Right. Because, and you know, so many commercial products are built on top of existing open source stuff. It's like that XKCD where it's like all modern infrastructure and all, there's all these blocks and there's this one tiny thin little block everything is relying on. And it's like that one maintainer in Kentucky who tirelessly supports that one package that supports literally all of modern infrastructure. It's like that guy should be given everything needed. You know, like the people who are working on those projects are, I don't know, but. It would be fun to have you on for an episode about like supporting open source or like sustainability of open source or something along those lines, because with hardware, there is an easy thing to sell, which is the quote unquote compiled version of the hardware. Like there's a much easier model for making money with open hardware. Software gets trickier because there's like the subscription model for a cloud-based service or like some features are paywalled and like people try and figure out all these different ways. And we just had Brad from Onsell come on and talk about how they're approaching that and, you know, what's their way of doing it. But it's a much harder thing when it's effectively free to compile and you still need to support the development of the thing. Money is the ugly thing that needs to get involved to, you know, you have to pay your bills. Hardware, I think it can be easier. And I don't know, I think it would be really fun to have you on for an episode talking about that and, you know, your approach to that.
Oh, yeah, I would love to talk about that, especially because I feel like with open hardware, it's not that there is an obvious way to make money by selling the compiled version.
Mm-hmm.
There is a deceptively easy way to make money by selling the compiled version.
You mean that it's deceptively easy to just, oh, we'll just make it and sell it?
Yep.
Yeah.
And if you stop at that, your company will be dead as soon as you're plumbed.
Exactly. Yeah. I hear that for sure.
Your approach to openness has always been like that desire for a two-way street and like, you give and you take. It's the way to keep the relationships healthy with your community, yourself, the maintainer. And I think hardware needs to be the same way. Like we see open source companies get burnt out and kind of jaded because they don't receive anything back.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you can keep that community alive, like how you do, it pays itself.
Or accept that you won't get anything back.
Yeah.
You know, you're providing it without warranty and also without expectation of response. You know, like you might put it out there. And it's like, if you don't hear anything back, you don't get contributions. You decided to make it open source, you know?
Yeah. Reciprocation's been kind of a big topic going around, especially like the 3D printing community.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of thoughts about it.
Good.
And cool. I have a lot of, and like, ultimately it boils down to like, I think people generally have a very narrow definition of reciprocation.
Uh-huh.
Where it's, you know, like in using the software analogy, where it's like pull requests,
right?
You know, send a patch.
Yeah.
No, historically, that's been reciprocation in software.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, especially with hardware, reciprocation can be so vast.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times, something that can be seen as reciprocation is taken as an affront or stealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, and this goes back to, like, you know, my response to Prusa and, you know, some of my general thoughts about, you know, the 3D printing ecosystem right now and stuff like that, where it's just like, there is a lot of ways that companies, that people can reciprocate, can add value to an open source project and its community.
Right.
And very little of those are pull requests.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I think about, you know, there's a, right now we're redesigning the spool holder for the feeder, and someone in the community made a different version as like a screw to like hold the spool on better. And it was not a PR. I don't know if the source is open, but let's say for the sake of argument, it's not. And they just like put up the STLs on printables or something like that. That is still a contribution in that they still put it up, and like even just sharing a picture of it, I can see that, and that will inform, oh, cool, they tried it this way, and that's a way that we could roll it back in. Like, just even ideas and like sharing, hey, look, I kind of did it this way, is a ton of contribution. And sometimes it's easier. Like, the contribution hoops to jump through for the Lumen project is not short. It's complicated trying to manage hardware and Git and make it so many people can be working on the same stuff at once. It might even be easier for them to just share the picture and let me just do the CAD. You know what I mean? Like that yeah. also counts as a very valid, helpful contribution, even though it's not a PR.
Yeah. And another valid contribution that some people might scoff at is, you know, the person that's organizing a group buy of all the components right. needed to build feeders.
Yeah.
Right. That's cutting you out of the loop
yeah.
as a company, as a sale.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's actually an extremely valuable contribution
yeah.
to the community and the project.
Totally. Yep.
So
yeah.
Yeah. You know,
we should totally have an episode about that.
And Theo, you're actually giving a talk at the Open Hardware Summit on like how collaboration happens in the Voron community, right? I'm looking forward to that.
I am. I'm also looking forward to that. I need to write it.
But I won't press you on a sneak peek yet.
No, I am really excited because I am going to speak with a couple of people involved in the Voron community, cool. both from the Voron team and from vendors. And that's really going to be the focus of the talk, is how vendors get along with the team and with each other.
Cool.
And, you know, how they don't often sling mud at each other in order to try to get more sales.
Sure. Huh. Oh, that's going to be good. That's going to be so
fun. Oh, my God. The Voron community is such an interesting ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like, like every project, there's good, there's bad. But the fact that it functions the way that it does and it's working is so cool.
Yeah. It's really unique. I've never really seen a community quite like it in terms of its size and method of operation. And also, like, the way that the design source will change and, like, who is allowed to make those changes. And, like, it's such an interesting thing how it works. I cannot wait for your talk.
I am hopefully going to write that soon.
Well, that leads beautifully into what is next for you. What's on your plate? What's coming up? What are you jamming on now? What's in your future?
Well, obviously, I have a huge backlog of things for Key Canvas that are making me feel guilty. So I'm not going to work on that at all. I joke. Yeah, you know, what's next for me is a little interesting. There is a software project for a hardware startup that is run by a couple of silly guys that I might work on over the next couple months. I don't have any plans for the next couple months for any more like synthesizer projects or anything like that.
Mm.
I am going to release my first guitar pedal design soon.
Heck yeah.
I don't know if that's going to be an actual product. It might be. It might not be.
Yeah.
But it is a dead simple guitar pedal. It doesn't even have an on-off switch.
Hell yeah.
And yeah, other than that, I'm working as the president of the board of directors of Oshawa, which basically just means that I am around for the executive director, Alicia, to bounce ideas off of.
Mm-hmm.
And she does all the work, and she's amazing. She's been doing all the work since forever. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that's mostly it. Just trying to be a good advocate, trying to write more, trying to earn enough money to feed my cats. And yeah, just hanging out.
That's great. Cool. All right. Well, we're at an hour 45, so we should probably wrap it up.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
All right, guys, that's it for this one. Thank you so much for listening. Thea, where can people find you?
Well, if you're the FBI, you cannot find me.
Okay, so aside them.
You can also find me on thea.codes. That's thea.codes. And all of my socials and antisocials and stuff are linked from there.
Cool. All right, awesome.
You can also find me on the Ocular Discord causing problems.
I don't think you've caused a single one. You solve a lot of them.
Yeah, mostly fixing problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, crap. I need to fix that.
There's time. Don't forget to leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us out a ton.
If you haven't heard, Google Podcasts is being shut down. So if you're listening to us on Google Podcasts, don't worry. We are everywhere else. So just go to podcast.opula.io and you can see all the places that you can listen, but it's pretty much everywhere where you'd expect to see us.
You can find Opula on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't forget to check out opula.io and sign up for our newsletter where we write blogs and do customer interviews with other folks building cool open hardware.
Also, we now have merch. If you want an Ohm shirt, there's a link to pick one up in the episode description.
That's it, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thanks, everyone. We can hit 20, 30% of this, and then we end up talking about weasels the rest of the time, and like, it's mostly all right. Like, people want open hardware, but like, if we're not on this...
Cool, we're going to talk about Alan Wake 2 the entire time.